Hello? Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm one of the organizers of the book fair, and right now it's my honor to introduce to my left, George Sinsenko. He was a veteran of the Djibouti Column, and he fought there when he was 16. And to my right, Mo Fishman, who is now currently the secretary of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, and also fought in the Spanish Civil War with him. So, without further ado. Without further ado, I'm going to pass the microphone to George Sinsenko, and if any of you have any problems hearing, just raise your hand or something, I'll turn the volume up on the PA.
Thank you, Patrick, for this introduction. Comrade, as you heard already, I participated in the Spanish Civil War. Now, I would like to go a little bit back before the Spanish Civil War. After World War One, the proletaire was completely down, the capitalism was taking over, and the people who participated in World War One were completely demoralized because there was a lot of discipline during the war. And so we kids, 16 years old, we were more advanced than the 40 years veteran from the war. On the other side, Hitler Mussolini was building up a force. The democracy was crumbling. The proletaire was completely down. The capitalism was winning the war because with the gap among the rich and the poor was growing every day. We were young. We had a fist fighting in Paris, my city, and the right wing, left wing. When came the election in Spain in 1936, and the Popular Front won, it was like a star coming in the sky for us, giving us a hope that the democracy and our ideal wasn't dead yet. And we were jubilant, we were happy, because we were surrounded by fascism and complete indifference from the democracy. United States, France, England, they didn't want to get involved with Hitler and Mussolini. We were completely isolated. We were happy. But suddenly, on July 19, 1936, Franco, the fascist, he came from Africa where he was in Morocco with the foreign agent, mercenary, and the selected soldier troops from Spain, invading Spain to destroy the Republic. They were taking town after town because Spain was a backward country at that time. 90% were analphabet. They didn't have a law. They didn't have any union. They didn't have any protection. The people didn't have lands. 70% of the lands belonged to the churches, and the rest of the land belonged to the rich people. When they didn't expect this fascism taking over one land after the next. And so we, the people living in other countries who have seen the star of the freedom of democracy growing, is losing. We lost our dream. The fascism was taking over. And so we decided to go to fight the fascism. It's a unique case in the world that from 54 countries, 35,000 volunteers went rushing to Spain to fight for the same idea, without any connection, without any appealing to each other, any propaganda. I was 16 years old, and I decided to fight also. I went to see the socialists and say, I want to fight in Paris, where I was living. And they say, how old are you? 16 years old. No, we don't want kids who will be crying on the front. We need soldiers and people already who have some experience. I went to see the communists. She said, no, kids, we don't want kids. I was desperate. I wanted to fight for the democracy. And somebody told me, why don't you go to see the anarchists? And okay, she went in the Place de l'Opéra in Paris, in a shabby building on the second floor. It was sitting a guy with a big belly and a red nose or a red wine drinker. He said, "What do you want, comrade?" I said, "I want to go to fight against the fascism in Spain." "Okay, come the next week, we have caravan going to Spain." He didn't ask my age, my years ago. Now, I then, the first time I had a contact with anarchists, I was Marxist at the time, but not to the very decided. In 1934, some comrade, anarchist in Paris, told me, "You know, Macron, he died. You know, anarchist Macron, the Russian Macron. And we have to go to the burial." And I assisted to the burial of Macron, who was a legendary anarchist fighting in Russia. I met also over there Berkman, Alexander Berkman, from Russian descent, an American anarchist who came all over, also participated with 300 people at the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, where Macron is buried. And so that was my first experience with anarchists. I started reading about Bakunin. I started reading about all the anarchist movement, and I was seduced by him. When I went to Spain, and we stopped a group of 16 French volunteers who crossed the border. At that time, the border was still accessible, and we went to Puigcerdà. Puigcerdà, like all the part of the north, the Catalonia and Aragon, was run by the anarchists. It was amazing. They had three factories with 300 to 500 workers in each. And that's the first time we have seen that the anarchism can succeed. There is a possibility to succeed, because too many people say anarchism is disorganization. No, anarchism is not disorganization. Anarchism is give the quality of life to everybody, opportunity, and we don't deject anybody. Everybody has the same opportunity, has the same value, the human value, not the money value, the human value. And so the owner of the factory ran away, they went to Franco. They established a committee for each one of the factories. They were run by them. They had also a monastery with 50 nuns. And so we dispatched one of our miliciano. The time before we were called brigadista, it was miliciano. And he came to the convent and he said, "Ladies, God is dead. And so this house doesn't belong to him anymore." And this is a beautiful building, and we will make a hospital of that. You get the work, and the one, the nun who opened the door, she stayed with the miliciano living with him. Through that, she didn't like it. Anyhow, after that, they were putting some order. They went to Ivrotil. There were about 30 prostitutes and 4 pimps with them. They said the same thing. "I know that the capitalism forced you to sell your body as to survive. Now you don't need to do that. You're a citizen like anybody else. Look for your job." The 4 pimps have been shot in 2 hours since we came over there. Yeah. We don't accept the exploitation of anybody. Anybody can own any other human being. We're against that. The money is not important for us. Prison, we don't need prison. We give a chance to everybody to start a new life. But if this person is committing crimes against the people, he would be shot or free. That was the first time I was brought to the anarchist system. From Puigcerdà, I was sent to Barcelona. In Barcelona, I hear speaking German, Italian, Czech. I said, "What are you doing here? I knew what you're doing here. We came to fight for Spain." Like I said, it wasn't organized. It was spontaneously. People come from all over. We organize ourselves. I belong to the Sebastian IV column in the army of Durruti. Durruti was a legendary revolutionary who had been condemned to death in the United States, in Spain, and in France. for his activity. And of course, when came the Spanish Civil War, he came to Spain, and he was directing an attack against a quartel, a barracks, a soldier. He said, "Listen, we are many, and there are not enough people to kill all of us. If we rush against this fortress, military fortress will be taken. We lost a lot of people, and unfortunately, Durruti has been killed by a bullet. Until now, we don't know where it went." Anyhow, we were sent in Aragon. In Aragon, we had the same process of liberation and the anarchist organization. It looked impossible because all of us, we are brainwashed since we are born by the capitalist system that the money is the only value. No, the money is not a value. The value is human being, the value. And there is no reason. I am maybe Don Quixote. I am maybe a dreamer. I cannot see a poor kid hungry on the street. I cannot see a homeless on the street. And I cannot accept that here, the richest country in the world, we have 1 million homeless. It's unbelievable. And 3 million people behind the bars in the prison. We have a high percentage of unemployed people. We don't do anything here. Ford Motor, General Motor, all that is finished. We buy in other countries where the labor is cheap. China actually has more dollars than we have. But we have to understand that in between the civil war, Spanish civil war, and actually now a lot of things happened, and the capitalists took over. They were finding places where they were paying $1 per day work. $1 per day. And little by little, the American worker remained unstable. The socialism, the communism, who was a hope of the worker, collapsed with the Soviet Union. And so the proletariat is completely abandoned, completely orphaned. Here in the United States, we have 10 or 7% of people, workers, belonging to the union. Meanwhile, in Europe, in Spain, they have 70, 80, 90%. If something happens, they declare a strike and they paralyze all the country. Here, the workers are completely abandoned. Anyhow, when we were fighting in Spain, and like I said, Franco was going, taking one town after the next. He was close to Madrid. And he was 10 or 15 miles from Madrid. And he said, oh, telephone, at that time they didn't have fax or email. The next Sunday I will have a dinner in that restaurant. It was the more expensive restaurant in Madrid, because I will be there. It was easy because he was going one town after the next. The Spanish, with guns, without instruction, without real idea, were too weak to face the mercenary army Franco. They sent us, the International Brigade, at the end of 1936, beginning of 1937. And we stayed. In the first month, 70% of the international have been killed or wounded, but we stayed there. Some of us never had a gun, never had shot. I will tell you my own experience. They gave me a gun, 100 bullets. I just said, okay, come over there and shoot any piece of paper, a stone, whatsoever that you're in training. And three bullets, we cannot waste more. That was my military instruction. But like the Spanish said, you need not only, the gun is not shooting by itself. You need to push the finger, and the finger, you need cojones, you need balls. And that's exactly. We had something, this ideal and this anger that they were stealing our ideal. Franco was destroying the most beautiful thing that we had. And unfortunately, if it weren't for the capitalist world and the power of Democrat, who didn't help us. We could have won the war. But Hitler and Mussolini were sending soldiers to Spain. United States General Motors and Ford Motor were sending 5,000 trucks in credit line. But nobody wanted to get involved. Roosevelt, who in my opinion was one of the best presidents we ever had, only before he died recognized that the biggest blunder of his administration was not to help the Spanish Republic. Because if the democracy hadn't been power, France, England, United States, we could have avoided World War II, where 56 million human beings have been killed, destruction, the shame of the Holocaust, racism, all that. All that has been that the democracy had made it guilty, I feel, because as now, also we have the Democrats who don't do anything. We said, the war in Iraq, which is not a war, it's a war of imperialism. We will maybe retrieve the soldier at the end of 2008. And we, veteran of the war, we go on the street, we post the same, bring the truth now. And so, we are again abandoned, completely abandoned, like it was before the World War II. What I try to say that we have now a new generation. We have a new resurgence of the anarchism. The people understand now that anarchism is not disorganization. We have an idea. We have a process. But the capitalism tried to create an ambient that without the capitalism, without the money, without the organization that we have, the world cannot survive. The American worker is much worse right now than he was 20, 30 years ago. I don't know what will be the future. Anyhow, what ended in Spain, we didn't have any help. The border from France was closed. Hitler sent 50,000 soldiers, 1,000 airplanes. Mussolini sent thousands of soldiers. Meanwhile, it was a trick that they outsmarted the democracy when the fascists suggested to create a no intervention. No intervention means close the border in Spain. Remove all the international, because we were not really, we were like I said 30, 40,000, we were a group of shuffle that the people could come to us. If there was a weak front, they were sending the international troops and we were fighting. They put us a condition to remove all the international brigades and they promised to remove all the German and the Italian. You heard of Guernica. Guernica is a town in Spain where the German pilot, who didn't have experience, they came training, destroying on Sunday all the town just to train, to see the guns and how to put the destroy completely the town. And they committed massacre, taking people to the cemetery, shooting people, anyhow. Once again, the democracy and even the Spanish government, they accepted and asked us to leave Spain because in 1938, and the Pasionaria made a beautiful speech when she said that you are hero, your history, and but that didn't help very much. Anyhow, now I hope that the young people, we are giving to the young people the torch of the freedom because it's too heavy for us to carry and you have the responsibility to keep them to fight. Now I would like to introduce my comrade Mo Fishman. Bautismo belongs to what Pasionaria said. He is here, his history, his legend. He has been fighting with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, his secretary now, and he never boasts 1 millimeter of his ideal, and he keeps on our side, on the side of the proletariat, and on the side of the democratic ideals.
Hello,
hello, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm standing because I like to see who I'm talking to and stuff, seeing you and receiving. You know, we, in America, the veterans of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade have been accused year after year by one reactionary committee or another, or the government even, of being tools of the Communist Party. And I put it to you that my comrade George over here is a living example that we're not tools of the Communist Party. If the Communist Party were running the Veterans of Lincoln Brigade, I don't know if we'd have taken them into the organization. He's given you the picture as he saw it and from where he came. Let me give you the picture that I have, coming from the United States, having been secretary since 1950, having accumulated a bit more knowledge than I accumulated when I was in Spain. Let me give you this picture of what the war was about and why we fought it and what we did there and why we came home, et cetera, et cetera. In February of 1936, a Popular Front government was elected in Spain. It was not a socialist, it had no socialist program. It had no concept of overthrowing capitalism. It was simply an election, which the first election took place in 1932 after the King of Spain abdicated. Excuse me giving you some history, but you have to have some background to understand what happened in Spain. And scholars, though I'm sure all of you are, I don't know if you've delved into the history of Spain to this degree. And the elections that took place in 32 and 34 were mainly won by the right, including the Fascist Party, including those who were for the king, how do you call them again? The
Carlists,
yes. And that election totally surprised the right in that the left center coalition, which consisted of the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, the Trotskyist Party. The anarchists did not vote in that election. It consisted of trade unionists, and it consisted of the people of Spain. And as George pointed out, some 80% of them were illiterate, did not read or write. And in that election, when the Popular Front won, by the way, the Popular Front concept was originated by the communists, and they succeeded in winning elections in two big states, France and Spain. I would say, much to our surprise, I was a communist at the time. I had joined the Young Communist League. I went to Spain when I was 21. This is the 70th anniversary. How old am I? So I go back a bit, but what I'm trying to do is give a picture of the political atmosphere at the time and what was happening. If the elections take place in February, and in July 18, 1936, La Junta organizes to overthrow the legally elected government. La Junta consisted of the fascists, the party of the fascists. It consisted of the army, the whole leadership of the army. It consisted of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. And it consisted of the businesses, the big businesses of Spain. The outstanding big man there, equivalent to what's his name?
Juan March.
Yeah, his name was Juan March. And they wouldn't stand for the revolutionary things that the Republic was introducing. Number one, it was gently releasing the iron hand of the Catholic Church on the whole educational system by creating public schools. It was beginning to tackle the problems of literacy. It gave the right to workers to organize in trade unions. And it gave women the right not to be slaves. They introduced legislation which made it possible for them to inherit, to vote, etc., etc. And this was too revolutionary a concept for them, and so they revolted. The revolt takes place in July. And how does a revolt take place? I don't know if any of you really know this. If you have the army behind you, you can always win a revolt. The way most revolts work, or at least in many countries, the army has army exercises, and it puts troops into the armories of a city, and they're engaged in exercises of one kind or another. The public doesn't know what the heck's going on. This is how they train their troops. In the case of an uprising or revolt, they put the troops into these armories, and at a given signal, the soldiers go out and they attack the public buildings, the parliament. They attack the telephone company, take it over. The newspapers, wherever they are individually, take them over. And when they have all of these things in control, there's nobody to fight them back, and bingo, you've got a victory for the revolt. In Spain, something unusual happened. They were the people who had organized and won the elections in February had done so by being in touch with each other. You had the various political parties in touch with each other. You had unions in touch with each other, fraternal organizations, and so on. And they suspected something was going to happen, and they were prepared for it. And when the revolt breaks out, the electricians call the plumbers. The plumbers call the dry goods workers, you name it, whatever union, and said, look, you go and protect the parliament building. Get all your members and go to the parliament building and stop the troops from taking over. You printers, you go to the telephone building and stop the troops from taking it, or if they take it, attack the telephone building and get them the hell out of there. Get whatever guns you have at home, blunderbusses, hunting rifles, whatever the hell you have, and go out there and take it. And everybody go, men and women. And you go, even if you don't have any guns, and when somebody falls, you pick up that gun and you use it. And that's what happened. And literally, you know, try to imagine it, what a tremendous achievement it was for these people to put. The revolt takes place in 15 of the major cities throughout Spain, and they are defeated in all but three of them. They are defeated in 12 of the big cities of Spain that they have attacked. And this is without an army and so on and so forth. Franco wins in three provinces close to Portugal. Portugal has sent some troops across to help them, and eventually sent 10,000. But faced with this disaster, Franco calls Hitler. And it's at this point only that the world learns that not only was this junta acting alone, but they had made an agreement with Hitler and Mussolini for support. They didn't think they would need it to the extent that it finally wound up, but that's the way it worked. And he calls Hitler and he says, send transport planes to Morocco. Franco is telling this, that there were the troops, the Moroccan troops that he had trained, and sent transport planes and transferred them to Cadiz. We learned later that the reason that the Moroccans were willing to do this, the Moroccans hated the Spaniards, who had occupied them, treated them as a colony, had forced them into the army, or coerced them, or the only way they could make a buck or make a living was to go into the army, but they hated all Spaniards. And he promised them that they could, any towns that they took, they could rape, kill, take property, do anything they pleased. And as long as they were killing Spaniards, they didn't take care if they were fascist Spaniards or anti-fascist Spaniards. They went because of this particular rule. Eventually, Portugal sent 10,000 troops, Italy sent 70,000 troops, and the Germans sent only 18,000. But those 18,000 were airmen and their planes, both bombers and fighter pilot planes, and the personnel to keep it afloat, to fix it when it came down, rearm it and so on, and the arms and ammunition to do that. He did the same thing with tanks and the same thing with artillery. And though their numbers were not as great as the Italians, they were more effective in terms of the fight against the Republic. With all of this, then he goes and reconquers Spain. If you see the map of Spain after the revolt takes place and they fail in 12 of the major cities, the major part of Spain is held by the Republic. But with the preponderance of arms and ammunition that are being sent to his side, his army begins to slice through what is literally a pretty much defenseless country. Those who had put down the rebellion formed what they called militias. And there were, as George pointed out, anarchist militias. There were socialist militias, left Republican militias, and communist militias, and trade union militias. And pretty much operating independent of each other. How are you going to defend against an organized army that's attacking you, as I indicated, in your own country? They had to act, and they had to act fast. And what they did was, I mean, you have a short break in period between July and the put down of the rebellion and the re-attack against the Republic, which begins in September. Now, that was a short period of time. But by September, the Moroccan troops were in the south, the Italians were sending troops, and the Portuguese, and the Carlists, and wherever Franco conquers any piece of the territory, he immediately drafts all the young people from 17 up, puts them into the army, and puts his troops or others behind them, forcing them to flight, whether they wanted to or not. There were some, I presume, that were fascist-minded and probably volunteered or whatever, but the majority of those that he has fighting for him were drafted. And it's against this that you have a Republic fighting. Now, if this had been a fight that had went on, whatever it resulted in, it would have been a blip in history, it would have been reported, and so on. What made it different was the fact that Hitler and Mussolini intervened. And they intervened at a time when fascism was on the rise, Japan and the Far East, Mussolini since 21, and Hitler since 1932, when he was given the premiership of Germany by Ribbentrop, who was then the president of Germany. Ribbentrop? No, I think it's a different name. So that what became obvious is this was a fight between the forces of appeasement, of those who were ready to appease fascism, and fighting, actually engaging in the fight against fascism. And when that became apparent, because the premier of Spain at that time, whose name was Caballero, he wanted to, what had happened is that a non-intervention committee had been sent up by Chamberlain, and under his leadership, they didn't want to get involved in a war in Spain, and their thinking was, as long as you could have the fascists fight the communists, they stood to gain no matter what the hell it was. So they didn't want to get involved in a war in Spain, and in effect, what that did was to stop the other democracies, including the United States, from selling arms to a fellow democracy, which had been the practice for years, that you sold arms, and it is today. You can buy arms all over the place by providing the money. The Republic did not call for volunteers. The Republic needed only to have the arms, and they felt that they could repel. Even when they found out it was the fascists who were supporting the junta, they loved their republic so much they were willing to sacrifice and try to beat the fascists. And so it comes to pass that Caballero, seeing that he couldn't buy the arms, he thought of the idea of calling for an international brigade, and he let the international brigade come across the border from France with two purposes in mind. Number one, he thought that if people, ordinary people, came from these countries, they could influence their governments to change from a policy of appeasement to one of active revitalization. And secondly, he got automatically, because there had always been a draft in Europe, he automatically got men who were soldiers, who were trained. And those who volunteered automatically became leaders in the militias and later in the armed forces of the Spanish government. So how do you get volunteers to come to Spain? It poses a problem. In democratic countries, they don't want you recruiting people to go fight somewhere else. And in fact, they make it illegal for you to do that. The world in 1936 was mostly colonies. It's like Latin America, Asia, the Middle East, the Far East were cut up and owned by the imperialists. How can you get recruits? It is our opinion, we don't have a paper trail for it, that and we know that it has to be so, that Caballero approached the Comintern. And he said to them, look, we would like you to recruit men and women to come fight in Spain, but that this is not to be a Bolshevik revolution, and you are not to recruit only communists. We will not permit it. And so that worked. All of the recruiting agents in the United States, it was the Communist Party, were told that this is what they had to do. And I can tell you from my own experience and what we know about the Americans who went across, there were 2,800 Americans, men and women, who finally volunteered to go fight in Spain. And of them, about 60% were members of the Communist Party. We had socialists, we had Zionists, we had trade unionists. The committee, I know, tried to get a larger grouping than the 60% to go across, and we were not able to do it at the time. But, you know, it's not an easy thing to go recruit people and tell them to go die. You have to have some kind of motivation. And the motivation lay mostly in the left. Why? Because the left and I, with the socialists, Trotskyists, everybody else, we had read Hitler, Mein Kampf, or about Mein Kampf, and we knew he was out to conquer the world, and we knew that if the policy that was initiated in Spain of not fighting fascism, but appeasing fascism continued, there would be World War II. And in letter after letter, we find the Americans writing home, saying that to their neighbors, their friends, their political associates and so on, we must stop fascism here. If we don't, there will be World War II. As a matter of fact, Horton Mifflin published a book of those letters. And the book is 600 pages long and doesn't include all the letters. And almost every one of them is saying the same thing. And you can say we were brainwashed and so forth. I don't think that's true. We understood that if fascism won in Spain, we would have World War II. My gosh, you know, life is what it is, and it proved we were right. Can you imagine a world which would not have had World War II? There's speculation what could have happened. Faced with a two-front war, we don't think Hitler would have started a war. Or if he did, he would have been shortchanged quickly, put out of business. In any case, it didn't happen that way, and World War II resulted. And the misery and so on. I want to pass my time. I want to leave time for you guys to ask questions, and that's why I want to make it as brief as possible. Yes, we fought, and we fought on really well. We Americans didn't have a draft, and fortunately for us, when we got across, which was 6 months later, the rebellion is July of 36, the attack of Franco against his own country starts in September, and Madrid is defended like mad by the people of Madrid. In January of 1937 is when we Americans got across. It took that long organization, and so on and so forth. By that time, the border had been closed. 96 Americans left on one ship, the first batch, on Christmas Day, 1936. And they crossed the border in a train. I didn't get there until February, and I had to go over the mountain. I had to climb the Pyrenees. That's a rough business. We used to have a song about it. Got nice and peaceful. All the quarters fold, and the gods are there. Oh, pray, what can we do? It's plain to see our task must be to climb the Pyrenees. Honey, 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 I love you, honey, little eyes, I love you. Love you, little eyes, and then the ball. Little eyes, I love you, little eyes, I love you. Love you best of all. One more verse. Oh, a longshoreman with Joey Sands. He handled the islands from all the lands. He's here in Spain with her unthought in mind to shove a banana up from those behind me. We fought honorably and well. We were chicken shit out to begin with. We were, and the fascists meant to hate us as much as they hated all of the international fans. They fought longer, harder, were less likely to yield to pressure, would go for weeks without relief because they were motivated. We were motivated. And we were motivated as anti-fascists. And I put it to you as an ideology, it is something separate, an ideology of anti-fascism. We all recognized that we were not going to get a socialist Spain. This was not going to be a Bolshevik revolution. It was made plain for us from the beginning. And that whatever the Spanish people were going to decide, and from the army was organized pretty much along the lines of the Bolshevik Revolution, in that we had commissars. And commissars were equal to the officer who was the military guy. And his job, in addition to making sure we got food, hot food if we could get it, best food we could get, was to hold bullshit sessions where he would read translations or get somebody to read translations from all the newspapers that were being published in Spain, from left to right. I know we didn't get the ones that the fascists published. But we were aware of all that was going on, and we were aware of the tremendous effort that the Spanish people were making. And to us, there remains to this day a love of the Spanish people for what they underwent in the fight against fascism, because they loved their legally elected government so much and would fight for it even though the fascists were involved. I remember seeing a movie fairly recently made in Spain in which some guy, I don't know what particular party he was, but he turns to his family. This is long after World War II, and they were in the concentration camps in France, and he turns to them and he says, if I don't know what the result would be, what tremendous sacrifices all of you would have to make because of the decision that I made to fight for the Republic, I don't know if I would have made it. And for that reason, as I say, we love the Spanish people, all of the Spanish people. I'm getting back too far. I will close. I hope you ask some interesting questions. I'll give you some interesting answers. Thank you.
Okay, so if you have a question, just raise your hand, and I'll call on you to stand up, and then just shout it as loud as possible.
I was in Spain last year, and I visited some different regions. And the Basque and Catalonia independence movements are very strong right now. I was wondering what the status of the independence movements was back then, and if those regions were supportive or opposed to the Republic, and how they fit into it all.
I have a hearing problem, and so I need my interpreter to repeat.
You people are all political, I don't know. I'm going to take to say, so that you can understand the political terms I'm talking about. The fight for national liberation on the part of peoples, peoples who are fighting to have their own country. We know that the plans for a state pretty much are people who speak the same language, people who have the same economic background, same cultural background, etc. And by and large, it doesn't affect us badly. We say, well, okay, I mean, the Kurds have been fighting for God knows how long for their liberation. The approach that I take, now this is not the International Brigade, it's not the Veterans League Brigade, the approach I take to this is, and I no longer remember the Communist Party, but this comes from Lenin, and he put it this way. He says, if that struggle, that national struggle, is hurting imperialism, is aimed basically at imperialism, he said, I would support it. If it's not, it's a struggle that's going nowhere. If they're going to end up in capitalism, they're going to have the same problem. Going to have the same problems all over again. It's not worthwhile. Now, to answer your question specifically, the Basque. We were delighted in Spain when we learned what a liberal, what the newly elected government of Spain of 1936 did with Catalonia, the Basque country, and Galicia. It gave them all kinds of full rights. The first time they could study their own language in their own schools, have their own ministers, that if you call it a state, have a state government, and so on and so forth. What they were not given the right to do was to secede and from the country of Spain. During the war in Spain, they were outstanding in their struggle against it, as were the Catalonians, as were the Galicians. The war ends. Franco is in power. They conducted a terrific struggle against the Franco government. Against the Franco government. It was just, you know, not more than any of the other of the anti-Francoists who were all going to jail or being tortured or being killed by Franco for their oppositions, trade unionists, members of any other political party, and just ordinary people who had lived under the Republic and loved the Republic and would make a remark against Franco and they would be subject to all of these things. As long as this was directed against Franco, it was, in my opinion, a just thing, a positive thing, and I support it. Once the Republic gets its freedom, which happened when Franco dies in 75, and there's a constitutional convention called in 76, and remarkable, it's the first time that I ever heard, it only happened that I know of, somewhat similar in Chile, in that the Constitutional Convention is called and everybody is asked to make compromises because they want to establish a republic, you know, they want to establish a constitutional monarchy. A constitutional monarchy. There would be no backsliding, they wouldn't allow a republic. And the various factions that were there, and they went from the communists, the Trotskyists, all the way to the fascist party. And you imagine them all sitting down with their own delegates and pretty much equal numbers of participants, or whatever the numbers were, and they all had to make compromises. And the one big compromise that those who were for the Republic had to make was to agree to a constitutional monarchy with, it was less of a democracy than what the British have, less of a, certainly less of a democracy that we have. But no question about it that it wasn't democracy. Given those circumstances, once that happened, we, the Veterans League Brigade, and pretty much all the rest of the International Brigade, said we had done our job. The first point in our Constitution was to help the democratic forces of Spain, which we did all through those 40 years, illegally, legally, whichever way we could, we helped the anti-fascist forces. And once that they had attained their democracy, we said any authoritative decision system, where they go, has to be a decision of the Spanish people, and we are not going to interfere. We have the right to interfere, and we must not take positions on it. Can I ask you a question?
Perhaps you don't know that the Basque people are one of the oldest people in Europe. They speak a language which is not related to the Anglo-Saxon, Slavic, or Latin. What they strive for centuries is independence. And so when came the Spanish Civil War, some of them joined us. It wasn't the majority. The majority wanted to independence, and as now you see that they have a group of people who strive to get to independence, and they commit some terroristic attack against the Spanish government. And so I don't believe the Basque people play an important role. They were undecided, and maybe majority were with us, the Republican side, but some also served with Franco.
Both to Mo and George. A couple of years ago, 2003, when the war began in Iraq, we organized what we thought was very similar on the model of the International Brigade. We went to Baghdad as human shields. We had 500 people from 34 countries, and our model was the International Brigade. Some of our people came back, were hassled by the U.S. government, they have liens against them, a lot of things. George says Roosevelt was the best of the U.S. presidents. I disagree. Could you tell me how many people came back for the International Brigade and were hassled by the government, placed in jail for the violations of the Neutrality Act or any of the persecutions that occurred when people came back from Spain to the U.S.? Could you talk about that?
Before we left in January of 1937, there had already been instituted in the Congress the House Committee on Un-American Activities. This was in reaction to the upsurge and the movement to the left on the parts of masses of American people. And their objective was to try to stop it. The harassment consisted of asking questions, and if they could catch you in a lie, getting the House to agree to what was the penalty, and you could serve up to a year in jail for lying. Not because you were a member of the Communist Party or a member of this or a member of that, just for lying. The harassment became more intense there was some harassment during World War II, in that the Army was interested in getting a questionnaire to all of the Americans who had fought in Spain. Why? Because they were the most recent Americans who went and endured battle. And they approached the leadership of the organization, and we saw the list of questions that they asked. We agreed to send it out. And the most important point in that was motivation. And the main point we made about that motivation was that if you were informed, if you knew what the heck you were fighting about, you were a better fighting man. I'm digress. Get back to the point. We were harassed during the McCarthy period. A special law was passed called the House Subversive Activities Act, in which, with no hearing and so on, the Soviet Union was proclaimed a enemy of the United States, and that it had its forces working in the United States, and they were the Communist Party, and all members of the Communist Party should register. They had a second part of the act, which was, I think, directed at us, but it was directed at organizations who were tools of the Communist Party. And the list that they used for this was the list promulgated by then attorney what's the name of the guy that now goes all over the place?
Tom Clark, you're talking about.
Who?
Tom Clark was.
Tom Clark, thank you. In any case, to make a long story short, we decided that most of those organizations were out of business. They couldn't afford to fight them. We decided to fight them. Why? Because it abrogated the constitutional right of Americans to join any organization they please, as long as they didn't break the law. And we were not breaking the law. In any case, to make a long story short, we won it. That was a kind of harassment. There was some other harassment. Answer your question?
Well, in the Neutrality Act, I know people were arrested when they got off the boats coming back.
No, the only ones who were arrested when they got off the boats were the ones who were non-citizens. They had what was called the green card. And if you had the green card then, you had to report to the embassy once a year. And the men fighting at the front were in no position to do it.
Talk to Eddie Belchowski.
Who?
Eddie Belchowski.
Well, whatever.
Next question.
I have a comment, actually, but it'll be brief. No, it's
this isn't
recording.
An application. This is recorded.
Well, you tell us, and we'll jump in.
I just wanted to say that you guys that. I feel that all of us really want to thank you because you guys have inspired our generation, I think, to go out and think internationally in a way that otherwise we haven't. And there are very few heroes that we can thank. And my brother here and I, our great uncle died in Spain. And so we haven't been able to properly thank you guys for doing this. But that you did it means a tremendous amount to, I feel like, what has happened in the world and our ability and our confidence in ourselves to make change.
Thank you very much.
Riding on your coattails. I guess it's up for one of us to decide what we think when we're in the same room with people such as you, but like, what would you, you two who went off and actually fought the fascists and everything, what? I just curious to know what you think when you sit in the same room with us right now. Do I sit down
now? Yeah. Well, it's amazing because I speak a lot at the university here in Spain, and I hear the same question. Very often, the young people ask us, what should we do, we young people? Well, I think that we have to wake up, shake us mentally, and get out this domination of the capitalistic system, which is brainwashing us that only the money is important. It's not the money which is important. We cannot accept that we have people who make $210 million a year and we're bickering to increase a few pennies to a worker. And we have in Asia about 300 million people who make $1 per day working. And so our obligation as human being is to strive for equality. I don't know, I repeat again, maybe I am a Don Quixote, I am a sentimental. I cannot see exploitation. I cannot see people homeless sleeping on the floor. I cannot see kids hungry. And we have to strive to make a society. And we have seen several attempts in our lifetime. The Marxism, socialism, communism. Unfortunately, Bakunin said the power pervert the men, and all organizations, they start putting a commissar, a chief, a somebody who is subordinating me. Well, as the anarchists, we have the real answer. I have seen, like I said, in Spain, factory, hundreds of workers, and they have a director, they have a board of we take decision, tell the boss, meanwhile the factory is working, but when they cross the line and close the door of the factory, they're citizens like anybody else, equal, that no other party, political party, has the same posture. And that's what Why collapsed the Soviet Union? Soviet Union, you had a class of commissar. The commissar had maids. They have chauffeur. They have no. We cannot accept exploitation. One man for another. We're all equal. And it's feasible. I have seen it in Spain, and it worked perfectly well.
Now that you heard George's answer, let me give you the answer of the Veterans Wing Brigade, which is not the Anarchist Party or the Communist Party or anybody else. We, during the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, was the first American military unit that was completely integrated. We had commanders who were black, rank and file, and so on. We participated in the fight for civil rights of our fellow black Americans, naturally, because of our background. And when that took place during the late 50s and through the early 60s. And we in the office would sit and have portion sessions, and the question would be asked, it only happened one time, who was braver? The guys, the young people who are going down to the South to integrate the cafeterias, to integrate the cafeterias, get black voters registered, et cetera, et cetera, or we who went to fight fascism and human gun. And unanimously we voted, they were braver. And I think you can understand that this action was a superior heroism. But then to basically answer your question, what can young people do today? You can only do what your times dictate, what the exigencies of a particular situation in which you are in. And it encompasses what George was talking about, social struggle. We veterans have been given a great deal of credit for being the granddaddies of activism. We're proud of that. And I guess it's true because we laid our life on the line. Certainly the young people going to the South laid their life on the line. You don't have to lay your life on the line. You just have to be a member of society and have a social conscience and get active in whatever phase it is and do your part, whether it's taking care of our planet or fighting globalization or whatever it is, but to be active. I would add to it, if you can, be an internationalist because it makes you a bigger and better person. You understand more. We were born internationalists and we remain internationalists. I guess that answers that.
Okay, I think we have time for just one more question.
Nice to see you again. I don't know if you remember, I saw you at a rally years ago, and we met that British gentleman who fought in the Spanish Civil War. My question is, I've done a lot of reading about the Spanish Civil War, including homage to Catalonia, etc. And I'm just wondering if you would comment to the degree that you know about it, that obviously the Republican forces were up against a fascist powerhouse backed by Hitler and Mussolini. But my reading, at least from what I read in Homage to Catalonia and other books, that part of the problem was that the left, very complex left in Spain, also here, was compromised in certain ways by the communists, who were pretty much ruled by Stalin, who was already trundling around with Hitler in a thing that ultimately led to the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Stalin certainly had no love for anarchists, since he was a megalomaniac. And I'm wondering if you would comment on that aspect of how that played itself out in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, etc. Because I think it's playing itself out again with the communists, for example, in China, becoming the mega capitalists of the universe.
Good question. I'm not answering as the Secretary of the Veterans of Lincoln Brigade. I'm not answering as the Secretary of the Veterans of Lincoln Brigade because they have not taken a position on this. There was politics going on in Spain before we came there. There were politics that went on while we were there. And the claims have been made. And interestingly enough, there is a John ex-president of NYU, Brademus, John Brademus, I understand he's speaking tomorrow here. He wrote for his doctorate paper on the anarchist, what happened to the anarchists during the Spanish Civil War. And I'm going to tell you, this many years later, I learned a hell of a lot from reading it. And I think the point that you're interested in this is the fact that there was a double revolution that takes place in Spain when the junta performs its rebellion. One is fighting back against the rebellion, and the second is in terms of a social revolution that takes place down on the ground. It takes various forms in various parts of the country, depending upon who is leading the government in those particular countries. In Catalonia, and to some degree in the Basque Country, the social revolution was led by the anarchists, and the anarchists actually took state power and held it, despite the fact that the legal authority in Catalonia, which at that point was composed of the socialists and the communists who had merged under companies to form one political party. And they were the majority, but you had the Liberal Democrats, the other factions of the United Front that had won in Spain, the Popular Front. And there was dual holding of power at the time. And the claim was made, and it was reinforced by what's his name in homage to Catalonia? Orwell in homage to Catalonia, that revolutionary spirit of a land that existed along with anti-fascism at the time was such that if it had been carried out all over Spain, it would have won the revolution. Argument. Even the anarchists had to finally agree that they had to compromise that position. Why? Because even though they created collective farms, took over factories where the owners had run away, kicked out those who did run away, set up workers' commissions to run it, and set up collectivization on the farms. But this was an ideal situation, but could not face up to the problem that if you lost the war, all of it would go down the drain. And so they had to make compromises. And I would say, I would have loved to have seen both these things coexist at the same time, but it was not possible. It puts me in mind of the utopian adventures that take place all over the world, particularly in the United States. If you know your history, you've had utopian little socialist things. Or if you want in Israel, the kibbutzim, or ideal socialist enclaves in a world of capitalism and so on when they began, and had to yield to the reality of what life is like. I don't know if this answers your question, but it covers the thing, right?
Okay, so that is it. At 4 o'clock, John Rawls and Al Giordano are going to be speaking here, so.